Hello, welcome to Relatable. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. I had the pleasure of talking with Tara Carcillo, the CEO of The Clearing, which is a strategy and change management consulting firm. I'm eager for the Relatable audience to hear about Tara's journey and insight. She is someone that always gives great and thoughtful advice. After our talks, I always feel motivated and inspired to go and do more. She candidly shares the highs and lows of her career journey, from the challenge of designing and fixing to the delicate art of diversifying a high-performance team while preserving workplace culture. She provides invaluable insight throughout our discussion. Listen in as she talks about the importance of intentional curiosity, her passion for improving or making things better, and what does she put on in order to get into that CEO mindset? You might just be surprised. Enjoy this episode.
Sitting down and having this conversation for a while. So I'm really appreciative of you doing this with me and being on the program.
Thanks for the time.
Yeah. So I welcome Tara Carcillo with me, and you're a CEO at The Clearing.
That's right.
So talk a little bit about what The Clearing is and what you do there.
Yeah. So The Clearing is a management consultancy. So we're a professional services firm. We provide advice and consultation to senior level clients, mostly in the public sector, a little bit in the private sector as well. And we focus on strategy and change execution. And we focus a lot on the human side of that. So understanding how individuals inside and close to the organization are going to experience the change, how to talk to them, how to work through it, so that the results are achieved ultimately by our client.
Sounds exciting. And you and I, every time we sit down and talk, I feel like we have a lot to talk about because we have a similar interest.
Yes, yes.
In terms of organizational change and development and human behavior and how people work. So can you tell me a little bit about what a day in the life is like for someone like you? How big is your consultancy?
Mm-hmm. We're about 135 people now. And let's see, a day in the life is a mix of customer and client time and internal stuff. Internal for me is like the operations of our business itself. So I might start with a brief 30-minute call with my senior management team, mm-hmm. where we're looking over the course of the week and sort of sharing with one another what are our most urgent priorities, where do we need help from one another. I might move from that into a conversation, say, with my HR team about the changes we're making to our performance management system, how people are evaluating one another. I might move from that to a client call. Mm-hmm. And on that platform is having conversations that are, you know, designing a future meeting for a client, working through some thinking or communication strategies that they're working on. I might move from that to reviewing a bunch of documents that need to be signed, like proposals and things of that sort. And then I might sort of theoretically end the day talking to my senior most person who's running the delivery part of the business, or my chief risk officer, and kind of just working through dynamics that we're experiencing. So it's a lot of channel hopping all day long, for sure.
And how do you like that? Is that something that suits your strengths in terms of being able to go from one thing to another? Do you find, is it hard to do that context switching?
I think I'm a little bit split on it. I love to learn and be exposed to different parts of the business because I think systemically. I like to see how the HR work is connecting to what the client needs, is connecting to what mm-hmm. my chief risk officer. So that part is fascinating and interesting and fulfilling. I'm an introvert by trade. So I will say that if you were to ask me, Tara, not as CEO, at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm exhausted. Like, I've had enough mm-hmm. conversation. This is enough, right? Because I do like to think and process and reflect. So I'm just really an interesting hybrid in that regard. And I sort of tug at myself.
Well, I'm glad you shared that because I am always about trying to dispel myths. I think there's a lot of myths about introverts and extroverts. And I think that introverts can be phenomenal CEOs and introverts can have a role that's people-facing, client-facing, and you can excel at that. And I think people may limit themselves or think that they can't do that or pursue that because that's maybe how they index or how they lean. So I appreciate that you shared that because, you know, you're obviously very successful at that and you're good at it, mm-hmm. and you have that type of demeanor.
One of the things I learned recently through a personality assessment was that my interpersonal sensitivity is really, really high. And for me, that was useful because I thought, oh, now I know why I feel so torn at work sometimes. I like the leadership position, I like the responsibility, I like being able to improve things, but because my interpersonal sensitivity is so high, I labor over it. How is so-and-so gonna feel? What's so-and-so gonna think, right? So it's just a really useful way of saying, okay, it's going to feel a bit painful, but it might not be a bad pain. It's just that my preference from a personality standpoint is to be interpersonally aware, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But if I overuse it, right, I could sort of, freeze myself up or exhaust myself. So yeah. It's just an interesting way that it was presented to me through the assessment.
For sure. And how long have you been a CEO
then? Almost 10 years, believe it or not. 2014 is when I succeeded one of the founders in this role.
Wow. Yep. Can you talk just a little bit about... That's actually longer than I thought, because yeah. I don't know that we've talked about that before, but I am curious. That's a good amount of time to be able to talk about. And what can you tell me what the size of the organization was when you
joined? I think we were about 12 people, maybe 15.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me just about the journey. I mean, in terms of, I have so many questions running through my head right now, but in terms of how you've manage that 10-year period with respect to, let's start with the respect to the ebb and flows, right? It's not always, you're not always high, you're not always low. So, and what you thought going into it, maybe, mm-hmm. and what you thought it would be like.
Well, I remember I didn't seek the role out. There was a senior person in the company, not one of the founders at the time, who knew that we needed to make a decision as a company and switch some things up. And I remember being on a plane with him. His name was Terry, and he was like, you know, you should be the CEO. And I thought to myself, what in the world? I was pregnant with my third child, and it was like the farthest thing from my mind. But it sort of stuck a little. And as the organization was trying to figure out, we weren't that many people, mm-hmm. Who's next, what makes most sense, who can we afford, like all the factors, I think I was in the right place at the right time. You know, I'm not entirely convinced I was the right person then, but I was there. And I was willing to take it on. And I remember saying when I accepted the job, so if I'm bad at this, can I just go back to consulting? And I'm now like imagining myself on the other side of that table thinking, what in the world? Like, but these two founders knew me, right? I had done professional work with them for many years. So I think that was also, something that they could rely on, right? I had history with them, even though I didn't have history in the role. So what I would say most is, aside from not having imagined it myself or myself in the role, I love learning. And I was able to, I think, initially perform in the role because I fundamentally understood our work. It wasn't that I was coming to the role because I was a financial whiz. It wasn't that I was coming into the role because I understood company operations. It was that I understood what we delivered to customers. And I truly believe that I sort of stood on that. I still stand on it to some extent, but obviously understand more about the mechanics of the business and the market that we're in and all those pieces. But I think back to, if I didn't understand consulting and I didn't understand people, I don't think I would have succeeded, frankly. Mm-hmm. I just don't. And it's my story that I make up, but I don't think that would have been the case. And I knew so many parts of the job that I didn't know. So I had to like really carefully manage my ego and also invite people in to be like, I have no clue about X. Could you stand beside me and help build this out, right, for the company? And so that I was reliant on people. But again, I think in the end, that served a purpose for them as well as for the company, because I wasn't coming in as a know-it-all.
Right.
I really didn't know it.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of like my personal journey, mm-hmm. and sort of how I assembled my executive identity along the way, right? I remember a long time ago, one of the senior people in the company said, you know, you're going to wake up every day and you're going to put on the coat of CEO, but that is not you. Like, mm-hmm. you are yourself, but you put on this coat. And that notion of like kind of forming an identity I think is super useful. I hear it talked about in the athletic field.
Yeah.
Right? When people say, well, when I step on the court and put that jersey on, I become this other version of myself.
Yeah.
And I think that can be a very healthy process to kind of be invested, but not have all of yourself, right, invested in the outcome of whatever you're taking on professionally. So
it's so funny, as you're talking, I hear the juxtaposition to being interpersonally
indexed,
like, and the armor, right? Not the armor, but that does make a lot of sense.
It's a shield.
Yeah,
yes,
for sure.
Absolutely.
And you need it.
Yes, I certainly needed it, right? Like, I'm super soft on the inside. So people would not believe that today, but I'm like. And then in terms of the journey of the company, what I had to become really comfortable with is not always seeing how we were going to get to where we were going to get to it. I would say, like, when I think about how are we going to meet this revenue target, how are we going to find the next customer or client? There were many, many years where we couldn't see past a couple of months. And that's super uncomfortable. And I think that could turn a lot of people away.
Right.
Because the risk feels really high, right? You're accountable for people and their jobs, and yet you can't see where the next dollar is coming from. So what I would add to that is, I tend to have pretty high belief. I don't know that I'm overly religious or maybe I'm spiritual, but I would be like, it's going to work out. Like, it's going to work out. And I'm sure other people were like, based on what evidence, Tara, right? But that's that duality, right? Between like some level of self-assurance, maybe a version of confidence, and the need for data, right? And over time, the business grew, right? I think we hired the right people. We had integrity about what we delivered. We got lucky. I think a lot of business is lucky sometimes. And that's how I, like, in a nutshell, kind of characterize the journey.
One of the things that I loved, and you started with it, because this is something that I learned at Deloitte, and I think it's something that has served me very well. And it's something that I tell others that are growing in their career around being anchored in the business. And by that, in terms of people talk about networking all the time, or they talk about getting promoted, or the managing of relationships, and the idea of being anchored in the business or what is needed. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big, I think we've talked about it before, but I'm all about what's the value you're adding.
Yep.
Like, how are you adding value? Whether it's, you know, within the organization internally, or how are you adding value to your clients, and how you, and every experience that you have with someone, hopefully they left that with some sort of, like, that was valuable in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was explained to me that it's through the experiences that the network grows. It's through, and that's the experience in business. So if the business is at the heart of it, or understanding it and recognizing what needs to be done, plus, to your point around, you understood people, I mean, that absolutely is a huge component to them being able to marry those two things.
Yeah.
Did you have a degree in business? Did you know that you wanted to pursue business? Tell me a little bit about your path to getting into consultant work. Mm-hmm.
I did not have a degree in business. My undergrad was in biology, so I'm sort of like a scientist by thinking, right? The curiosity, how does that work?
Brene,
why does it work that way?
Brene Brown,
right? That worked. But I knew I liked people. And again, at the time, I think I was like very small-minded about the options for how to apply my biology degree. But nonetheless, I enjoyed studying science. But while I was in college, I participated in a lot of leadership workshops. And I remember, at the time, I actually had a mentor who died shortly after I graduated school. And I remember saying to him, can I get a job in leadership? You know, and I remember him looking at me like, I don't even know what you're talking about. But oddly enough, I had done these workshops. He had started this program, which at the time was a little bit novel. Like, now they're everywhere, right?
Yeah.
But at the time, I think it felt like it was a little bit cutting edge, so to speak. But when he passed away, I took over a portion of his job, the student leadership program. And so then I had this job in leadership, which completely freaked me out, right? Because here was this exchange of this person in my life that had such an influence that now I was filling, you know, one of his shoes. He had a bigger job than just the student program. And so then I studied leadership. Like, I remember my girlfriends would be like, what are you reading? What is this on your bedside table? You know, everyone else is reading, like, some sort of, like, you know, romance novel or thriller, you know, and I was reading, like, The Principles of Leadership Theory or something. So, so then I did some studying, right? I really looked into, like, are leaders born? Are they made? How do they grow? And I coached rowing for a little while. My path was not direct. So I did a leadership program, was a rowing coach, and then pursued a master's program in something called whole systems design. And that's essentially a change management master's, OD master's. Mm-hmm. And then that gave me a little bit more of a perspective on how to do consulting work, what organizations look like, what leaders in organizations face. And through some of that network, I met people who are doing consulting. So I finished my graduate work and actually didn't have a job. So I did all sorts of stuff. Like I sold jewelry at the retail counter in Hex department store outside Baltimore for a little bit. And it wasn't the fine jewelry counter, as my girlfriend likes to remind me. So I did that. I actually did some construction for a little while because somebody needed an extra hand. And then made my way into the consulting field again through a series of relationships. And I was junior at the time, so I came in with the right degree. Mm-hmm. That helped, right? I didn't really have a lot of experience. And then that was like maybe early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And post 9/11, I was doing a lot of government work, right? A lot of work with the Department of Homeland Security. And then again, further built the theory stuff into how it actually works. And then I'm speeding up the story, but I spent a little bit of time in government. I worked at GSA, the General Services Administration. I worked for a startup that failed and then found my way into the clearing. And some of the same folks, again, that worked in the clearing were folks I've worked with in other companies. Mm-hmm. So that level was really important, even though I left and did other things. Like, you know, some of those ties just stay put. Yeah. If somebody calls you 10 years later and says, I need a job, you're like, great. You know, so luckily I hadn't burned a bridge. Yeah.
Do you feel like, because as you're talking even through it and the fluidity of it, are you someone that you talked about before, that power of belief, but the optimism of, I guess the question is, how calculated were you, or mm-hmm. was it more what's in front of you, taking advantage of those opportunities and having faith that the next thing will reveal itself? Maybe that's,
I would not characterize myself as calculated. Yeah. I'm more calculated now mm-hmm. than I used to be. I think that I was, the belief was a piece, and then also I sort of listened for the invitation. So I'd be like, okay, I need a job and I want to be doing this. So where's the invitation? And the offer might not look exactly as I was picturing it, mm-hmm. but I'm like, okay, maybe this is just the next thing to do.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that it was comfortable. I want to say that, but I didn't get too wrapped up in the permanency of things. But oddly enough, I was thinking the other day, in my first consulting company, I was there for almost 8 years. So I really didn't, even though my storyline sounds like there was lots of moves, there was like a long period of like static.
Yeah.
And then like, but, and then I would move.
We're very similar. Really? It's just, yeah. So when I graduated, it was a recession. So, and I also had dreams of being an actress. So I left and went to LA, and it was just good timing because there were really no jobs anyway. Right. So it's like, why not?
Why not?
And I had grown up in the Northern Virginia area. I went to school here. I think for me, on the maturity side, I really just needed to experience something radically different and shake my stuff up. And so similarly, like in those kind of early days post-graduation, I wouldn't say aimless. I always had a thing I was trying to do, but I think I needed to mature and figure mm-hmm. things out and take a lot of different types of jobs. And then I eventually came back and was really my first exposure to HR work for a staffing agency, like for the agency, not temping. And I was like, oh, I didn't even really know about human resources. Right. I really didn't know about OD. And I was like, this is like, oh, this makes complete sense. And then it was like, the thing that we talk about on here a lot is the idea of that intersection of what you enjoy, what you're curious about, and then an opportunity to practice it.
Yes.
And it takes a while to find that thing. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing, too, when you talk about your CEO life, when you said that there's some aspects that you knew and then some aspects that you had to grow in, I think the idea that you may already have touched on those aspects of the role in your role as a consultant.
Yes.
And I had done it previously. I had a large team, and you don't even realize what translates. So when someone said to you, you can be CEO, you're like, are you insane? And then you start to, when you're in it, you're like, oh, I have, in some way, I've done this before. Maybe not directly.
Yes. I can see parts of it. That's right.
And so, and then I really liked what you said too about the idea of not knowing and knowing what you don't know and trying to find the right person. Mm-hmm. That's such a skill. Mm. And I think it's an underrated, and we don't really talk about it enough. Can you talk, and obviously as a CEO and you have your leadership team, but then you obviously have the people that work in the firm, and then you have your clients. So you're kind of people selecting all day long. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that process for you and how you have refined that over time in terms of finding good talent. I think it's a challenge we all face in terms of, you know, you can't give a personality test mm-hmm. when you hire people.
Correct.
So what have you learned over the years in terms of what helps with that?
Realatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa, visit www.tfasoftskills.com for more information.
The first thing that comes to my mind is I've matured in terms of there's people that I'm comfortable with that may not be offering me the advice or value I need at a given moment. So one of the senior members of my team, we work very hard to find a way to relate. Fundamentally, we're aligned in the goals that we're trying to achieve, but this team member often challenges me quite aggressively. Tell me about this. Tell me about that. Why are you thinking this way? Why are you thinking that way? And I find that that improves my thinking. It takes me out of this, like, just trust me. It'll work out, right? This other person's like, no, I'm not going to just trust you. Like, I'm going to make sure there's fidelity behind your thinking. Like, it's probably right, or it could be right. But in order for you to get all these folks around you to execute it, it's not enough for you to just like sell a big dream, right? I'm being a little bit flip, but
yeah.
So I've come to really appreciate challengers next to me. And it wasn't until this was pointed out that I realized that a lot of folks aren't challengers for all sorts of reasons, right? There's identity reasons, there's experiences we've all had in organizations in our life. So I now like seek that out and look for it. And then I have to manage myself in the moment. Because then when the person's challenging me, I'm like, what on earth, right? But
can you dial that back?
Yeah, you know, like, I know I asked you to this meeting, but can you just not talk for the rest? So I've matured there in seeking it out and then internalizing it and turning it into like a better product or a better plan or you name it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is I think that I do kind of own and value the fact that I'm interpersonally sensitive because I realize that it has been an asset for me to get through hard conversations with people and keep people on board, right? In the game with me, so to speak. And so I think there are times that I also, a bit on the contrary, but not quite, go to the other end and say, who's going to understand the nuance of what I'm trying to do? And that either they can help me improve, again, the approach I want to take, or they can design it on my behalf. And that's really important in managing a business because sometimes people ask simple questions like, you know, can I pay for a team member to come to this event? Mm-hmm. Well, what's behind it is a lot bigger story about what they're trying to do with their team. But if I have a senior member of the team who's only looking at that through a financial lens, now I have a problem. So it's that idea of discretion, right? Where's the human component? What's the result we're trying to achieve? And the ability to kind of hold multiple realities or perspectives at once. Yeah. I think that's really unique. So I think if I don't have humans that have that expansive nature, then I make sure I assemble that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In different humans and then sort of listen to the like harmony of it or lack of harmony, but say, okay, I got to hold all these and then make a decision.
It begs the question as you're talking, I have to ask in terms of the cut and run side of it, right? So in terms of when something's not working and the performance isn't there, how have you, as someone that indexes on the interpersonal and the feeling side, how do you drive high performance?
Mm-hmm. I would say if I were looking at myself critically, I'm slow to make a people decision. The benefit of that is it allows people to fail a bit and potentially adjust. So it can create a culture mm-hmm. of growth. Mm-hmm. The short side of it is that I take too long to make a decision. So I watch that. And I watch, again, now that I have the language, okay, am I being overly sensitive here? part of my job is to get the result, whatever that is, the client happy, the number, pick the thing. And so I think I've improved there and also become more comfortable with, as a human, as Tara, the loss of relationship, right? Because you make those decisions and then it's like people that you were friends with, sometimes you're no longer friends with them. And in small companies, that's challenging. You know, that like, I don't know that I feel a huge amount of grief, but I recognize that. And I'm like, ugh, it's too bad.
It's interesting because for a long time I led the function that at the two companies where we were responsible for exits. And we were responsible for assessing the risk associated with exits. We were responsible for shepherding leadership through how to execute on the exit. And, you know, I joke sort of that with other people that there's a special place for me when this all ends because I fired either at my hand or my team's hand, right? It's pretty... and I think in a way, because I am like you, I think I bring a humanity to it that is really important. And and for other people out there that are in the CEO seat or a senior level seat that has to make these decisions, the thing I've learned that has helped me and I think can help others is that ultimately, because I do believe in like a bigger purpose or the right fit or the right match. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people need a push.
Yeah.
And it's okay if it didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
And just because it didn't work out doesn't mean you're a loser. And it doesn't mean you, CEO or business person, are evil.
Yeah.
And I think if you can normalize it a little bit and understand that there are a lot of different levers that come to play when you have to make those decisions. Sometimes it's performance-based, sometimes it's what's available in the market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lots of different ways this happens. I think what's helped me is to say this, it's so in the moment now. You can't understand what might happen in a couple of years, probably even a shorter window than that, that might benefit the person and you and the business. So it's hard, but maybe that's my own rationalization, but I do feel like it, and it has come, because I've been at this for a while, it has come true over and over. I've had people say that was probably the best thing you could have ever done for me.
Mm-hmm. Which, I think it's a way to hold it, right? Because you or I are human too. And I'm with you. I think there's like a level of ego sometimes that goes unchecked when like, how am I supposed to know what journey this person is on?
Yes.
Right? Like get out of your control mode and get into like, okay, handle this well, handle it with integrity. Right? Treat the person well in the process. Yeah, it's like you can jump to different parts of your brain on how to hold it. A colleague of mine who runs an organization reached out recently and asked me, like, how do you hold it? I have to lay a bunch of folks off because of the economy and the impact of the organization. And I walked through, you know, somewhat similar path that you set. And I said, you have to know and remind yourself that in the end, you took the job that says you have to take care of the enterprise while you respect the individuals that are part of it, and the point that, you know, you don't know what's next for them. But sometimes I've also had employees who behave in such a way that if I hadn't let them go, they would have never quit.
Wow. Right? Yeah, like, there's a whole thing I write in this book about knowing when to leave. And we could push boss and talk about this for a long time, because I think it is such an interesting concept of when to leave. And there's so many times that I feel like if we could do a better job in corporate America of being able to sit down with each other and say, Tara, I think I'm going to be ready to leave in 3 months.
Yeah.
And for you, Tara, CEO, to say, okay, tell me a little bit more about that. And let's figure out a plan. And let's have a nice transition and exit where we have this open dialogue. And it's just not the case. It's we're protective. Where, you know, I think people tend to want to get the most they can out of a situation, and that's part of self-preservation and other things. But to your point of like, you know, there's so many different ways we could do this better.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that sometimes you have to be the one, because they're not going to volunteer that, or it's very rare.
Right.
And need to be told. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, you know, I just thought of this too. I think our human nature to be comfortable.
Totally.
So why would I disrupt my comfort, you know, unless someone's really I mean, there's maybe a small percentage of us that sort of seek that discomfort regularly, but most of us just mm-hmm. like to be comfortable. You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about just one of the things I like to ask people in terms of your path, you know, a moment that, or it could be like a mentor or a moment that really shaped how you operate in the world. I feel like we all have probably several of these moments mm-hmm. that really might make a pivot for mm-hmm. us or create an opening that you thought wasn't possible. Can you talk a little bit about that, whether it's been personally or professionally and contributed to where you are now?
I've certainly have a ton of personal, but the two professional ones
yes.
that come to mind are in my memory. I don't know that these conversations happened as close together as they are as I've recorded them
yes.
right in my mental
sure.
file. But I remember I was at the clearing at the time, but I was not in the role that I'm in today. And I was doing what we call a chalk talk. And it's sort of like you come and we surround you with a few smart people and you talk about what you're up to and we help either affirm the direction that you're in or add to it. You walk away a little clearer, right?
Yeah.
Like a little clearer on your plan. And there was a woman who attended that chalk talk, and somehow at the start of the chalk talk, she was asking about me. And she asked, like, so what have you do? What do you do? What have you done? And the nut of the conversation was that she made a statement like, oh, so you haven't really done anything yet. And I was furious in the moment, right? Because I had clearly done things. The point, I believe, that she was making was I had not yet held a level of accountability for an organization or a team that was significant. And I was so mad at her. Like, I was like, you know, still, I could tap into that, like, in a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, so that was one instance, but it, like, stuck with me. So I was like, why is that sticking with me? Like I have no relationship with this person, and it has not sustained. There was nothing, you know, there's no reason for it to stick. Then I remember being in a separate conversation with a mentor of mine where I was realizing I was in a role, I believe it was when I was in government, where I was in sort of a helpless place that I couldn't affect the change that I wanted and was kind of like doing these mental loops around, I have these ideas, but I can't get it done. And it's the system and the people. And I wasn't quite in a victim place, but I was like just deeply frustrated. And then like fast forward to the conversation with my coworker who says, you should be the CEO. And there was this collision in my mind between these feelings of deep frustration, this comment that this woman had that really stuck with me, and this opportunity that I was like, well, I'm not qualified for that. Like, why would I be qualified, right? Because I had that as part of this whole, like, mental mm-hmm. paradigm. But I feel that the intersection between those, like, individual conversations kind of put me in a place where it was like, well, are you ever going to get this opportunity again, Tara? Is anyone ever going to say to you, come be a CEO with no background? Now, maybe, I don't know, right? I certainly couldn't predict the future, but I was like, I don't know. I would rather try this and fail and say, I don't want it, it's not for me, or I'm not good at it, or whatever, than not embrace it. But I think that, again, the feelings of frustration coupled with the opportunity, I think was pivotal for me. And I think helped me to realize things show up if you're looking for them. And again, they might not come in the form that you expect.
Yeah.
You might have to sacrifice other pieces of your life or experience in order to get that one piece.
Mm-hmm.
But don't lose sight of what you're attracted to and what you're good at. I think it's both, right? I think one of the sharks on TV says, like, don't always chase what you want to. Like, yeah, you have to couple it with what you're good at, right? Like,
yeah.
It's got to be a little bit of both
yeah.
in order for you to find success and sustain it. So I don't know if that answers the question, but that's what came up for me, that intersection of the.
Well, what I love about that too is the idea that this person that sparked, you didn't use the word, and I don't know if insecurity is the right word, but the fact that she was exposing maybe something
yeah.
in you that you felt like you had done, and here's this person questioning that. I think there's so many that buy into that then that prevent them from when you get tapped to do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you were like, had enough wherewithal to say, what if I don't get this again? And let me just try. And I love that you said, what if I fail, I can go back?
Yeah.
Because there's something, I don't know, there's something about that vulnerability that I think allows you to do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's maybe not, you're, I know, it's like you think if someone tells you something like that as a leader, like, well, I'm going to kind of try.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, are you not fully committed? Yeah. But I think the idea that, like, my husband gave me this language, I've said it on here before, but it really has helped me. If I don't understand something and I feel like I should, mm-hmm. I'll own it right away and say, can you talk to me like I'm 4 years old? Maybe I should know this, but I don't. And maybe that's the advantage of being in my 50s. It's hard to say that when you're 25 or 30 and you're really trying to make a name and you're trying to push and yes. be, you know, make. I understand that because I sat in that seat for a long time of just, it was through your performance that you got other opportunities. Yep. And so you were just dialed in on that. There is a freedom, though, in the not knowing and in welcoming that and then trying anyway.
Yes.
And I feel like that's such a great example, honestly, yes. of that kind of story. And then hopefully if people are listening, it's like, go for the thing.
Yes.
Even if you feel like you can't do it.
Yes.
What do you find with, in terms of your role, let's talk about it. I like to talk about, like, the thing that kind of excites you every day and maybe the most challenging aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe start with the challenging. Mm-hmm. What's the most challenging component of being the CEO of this size organization?
Mm-hmm. One thing that's challenging is that I've been in the seat long enough having designed things that are now working or not working. And now it needs to be sort of like optimized or refined or fixed, right? You know, if I were in my home and someone said the dishwasher's not working, I would die inside because I'd be like, ugh, I have to go in there. Da, 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 like the voice, the energy. So I'm not, to some degree, by my own classification, a fixer or optimizer. I feel more comfortable as a designer.
And the creative.
Yeah. So as the company has grown,
yeah.
it needs to be refined and optimized and think like, let this go and replace that with this. And so that is harder for me. Maybe it's harder because I was in the design role to begin with. I don't know. But that's challenging just in terms of the type of what's asked for or needed in the company. In addition, I would say we've worked very hard to try to diversify our workforce. And while maintaining some consistency in culture, those two things can really tug at each other, right? Add more people who have different world experience, but maintain consistency of experience from a cultural standpoint. That's also very hard. And I feel like I trip a lot along the way, you know, and I'll say, oh, I was trying to do this and that didn't work out. So that feels like a high wire act at times that is important to stay on because I think both matter, but it's really hard to stand on the wire, you know, making those choices and kind of being in that. You asked a second part of the question. That's what's challenging.
Yeah. yeah. And what excites you? Like, what is it when you're in the, you know, we call it the shower test where you wake up and you're like, oh, I'm excited to get after this today.
Yeah. I love meeting new people who are on projects doing things that I never could have conceived of. You know, and they're like, this is this thing that I've built and this is what I'm doing with the client. And I thought, oh my gosh, right? Because we had this engagement that might have started small, but has grown over time because the team has nurtured it and grown it. Now this new person is in the company adding to the thinking and making it better and bringing whatever they had before. That is super fun to meet really, really talented people that join the company. And then also watching, you know, in some of our government consulting work, the sales cycle is really long. And so you can spend years trying to position yourself, right, to win a contract. And recently a team of ours was awarded a contract that I want to say was over 5 years in the making.
Wow.
And I was like, man, like they have hung in, right? And it's not they, like I'm, but like, that's a long time. And I said to them, this is such a big deal because people come and go in consulting. Rightly so. They come, they spend a year, they do something else, they don't fit, they do fit, they want to make more money. So the fact that there was a set of people that had sort of endured over time, that felt special. You know, probably like how people feel that do mountain climbing or these like long-term things, you know, where you're like, man, I remember I was at the starting line. So I appreciate those moments as well.
How hard is it? I'm interested in this personally, but then I also think there's there's value for the audience in terms of going from 12 and being a contributor yourself to, you know, letting go and really letting other people do all the delivery and letting, you know, and really being more of an operator at this point. Mm-hmm. And especially as it's evolved, I suspect it's more and more in the operation phase. Mm-hmm. And you're not, you know, how much you're relying on your team mm-hmm. to manage your clients, to do delivery, you know. How hard is that to let go of? Is that something that is gradually and matures over time so you don't even know you're doing it? Mm. You know, do you find yourself at times thinking, I could really do that better myself?
Teresa's new book, Soft Skills I Learned the Hard Way, is out and available on Amazon. She writes about many epic fails throughout her career and how she learned from them so you don't have to. This book is full of cheat codes for how you can differentiate yourself when it matters, like in interviews, trying to get a promotion, or being a first-time leader. As always, thank you, Relatable Community. We are so grateful for your support and continued listenership. As of today, we are 10,000 listeners strong. Now back to the show.
I think it happens two ways. I think the privilege of being in an executive seat is that you learn, in some cases, like at twice the rate of someone who's just on one project. And so, again, having had the privilege of tenure at this organization, I was exposed to things all along the way. This is connecting to this. This is why this isn't working. So I feel, in some instances, that I've learned faster. So in some cases, people shove me out. You shouldn't be doing this anymore. And in fact, it's weird. It's weird to have the CEO designing this part of the system or the project. Like they say this frankly to me. And I get it because it distorts people's experience. I'm like, why is she in here doing this? Now, part of me is like, I just like designing and doing. But I'm realizing just as of late, and it's probably because the management team has continued to like really mature and like handle things. They're like, get out, get her out. Get her out, you know, respectfully. So there's some of that where it's like, no, don't do it. And then if you do it, it actually gets weird for everybody. So that's a thing that I've learned where you are replaced in a good way, but not sort of by your own doing. And then other times I would say I do have a bit of a, I'm a high individualist. So if you and I work together, I would believe that you could do a lot more things than maybe you could believe. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit of my bias. And so I have found over time that in some cases I leave people too far alone and they say, geez, like it would have been nice if we could have spent a little more time together. And I think, oh, but I thought you could do it. Right. And in my mind, right from my seat, I'm like, I'm giving you a lot of room. I'm not a micromanager. I'm not this.
Yeah.
So I think it's very distorted and I think it requires lots of sort of checking in. Like, am I giving you enough? And then do you have the courage to say to me, I don't know what this is and I want time with you. Or not. So the candor has to be there, you know, for them to feel like they can shove me aside respectfully or ask for help when they need it. So it feels a little bit like a fun house in my mind. It's tricky. You have to rely on lots of different people to kind of nudge you, but also, you know, sort of wake up each week and saying, is this the best and highest value of my time? Not because I'm like hoity-toity CEO, but because if other people don't learn this thing, well, the system now that I'm responsible for making stable and sustainable isn't. Because I've stepped in again and again and again to do that part. So that's a little bit of my journey there. It's a real mixed bag. But so a little bit of knowing my inner stuff, but a lot of listening.
Yeah, and I think the idea that you know, humans, you run a human bit. This is the thing with consulting professional services. It's humans. And so you're constantly having to check in on who the person is, how they operate, what's their index, and how do you get the most for them, and how do they get the most for them, and how do they get the most from you? And it's to your point around that dance of being able to identify. It's not a easy place to just peanut butter approach and then it'll just work out. Mm-hmm. You know, it does require that because what way work for you and I, you may give me a ton of rope and I love that and I'm thriving. And then you've got someone next door here that like needs a little bit more you time and needs to feel that connection and just a slight adjustment. It doesn't mean you have to overly micromanage, but like could mean the difference between that person's engagement and how they deliver. So I think being open to that, I love that you have a little bit of humor about it too, in terms of like pushing her out, like being, I think, in tune to that.
Yeah.
Like it's happening and like, okay, I need to step aside here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's very abrupt. So that's good. Okay, let me ask you one other question, and then I have just a couple more about feedback, because I'm obsessed with being able to talk about feedback, constructive feedback, how to take it, how to give it. What's some feedback that you've been given in your path that really made an impact on you, and either was surprising or resonated such that you're like, okay, I'm going to take that to heart and move on it?
I get so much feedback from employees all the time. So it's like picking through all of that. Yeah. One moment that I can think of is early on when I was in the CEO seat, I was, you know, in high learning, high movement, very busy, like all thrusters were on. And I would often arrive to meetings a little late or 15 minutes late. And I would spend all this time apologizing. And there was a gentleman who was working with me at the time. And he's like, you need to stop apologizing. Stop saying you're sorry. So there's like when I have had someone who takes a minute to really watch me, right? And feels the space that they can be like, don't do that anymore. That was pivotal. That same individual also later on, originally by title, I was the president, but not the CEO. And this individual who was coaching me again was like, why aren't you the CEO? Like, what's going on here? And I was like, well, I don't know, with the founders, ooh, I had all this like, and he was like, just stop, like, become the CEO. Go back to the founders and say, I need to be president and CEO. Make it very clear that you are holding down that role. And that wasn't a super comfortable conversation. And my ego was like, but I don't really need it. And he was like, stop already, like step into it. So people that have been blunt and direct with me, when they catch a pattern, has been super, super helpful. And then I would say other feedback is, you know, some feedback you're given, you can correct. Mm-hmm. And you're like, got it. I can make an adjustment right now.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the dialogue we're having as a company around world events, it's not that simple. And so I get feedback often, you know, you made a statement about this event or this moment, and you missed this part. And recently I said back to the company, like, hey, a group of individuals gave me feedback. I'm probably not ever going to get this perfect. And I just like said, so, but I welcome you being in it with me. I'm committed to improving and understanding, right, the impact of my statements as a leader. But it felt much more like a process that was like, I was never really going to perfect. And maybe I didn't have to, but that felt weird inside. I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to keep working this, you know, versus like, whatever, lifted weights and my biceps are strong, you know, like,
yeah.
I prefer that because it's so concrete and terminal. But these positions often, and again, as the world changes and the business changes, you end up in situations that you're like, you're not going to fix that.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating how much people are looking to their employer for certain things that I think is ever changing. And I'm sure it's a challenge of all CEOs for all of time, depending on the time period you're in,
yeah,
and adapting to what the environment needs. But it isn't, and I find it a lot in my consulting engagements,
yes,
frankly,
yeah,
on the people side, yeah, with respect to, I have CEOs talk to me a lot about, what do they want from me?
Yeah.
And how, and not in a, no, I don't mean that either in a negative way. It's a, you know, should this really be something that an employer is either doing or talking about or directing?
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that, what's interesting, if you think about my, like our demographic, a lot of us were told exactly what cause you should spend your day volunteering for,
yeah,
what days you're going to get off, how you're going to do, right? And so we, I think, as a unit of people have said, I didn't really want my employer telling me exactly how to do this and how to do that with respect to the either whether it's your personal side or it's that, you know, that kind of where it starts to bleed. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's a little bit of that pendulum swing, but it is interesting for you to be in that seat, mm-hmm. that has impact that perhaps you're thinking, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then figuring out how to navigate that is certainly really tricky.
Yeah. Because I can say, I don't think this is my job, but it's an expectation.
They want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what I'm trying to be in on this topic is to be in a space where, again, we stay in dialogue.
Yeah.
And there's certain things that I'm like, I don't want to take a professional position on. You can want me to. I will be in dialogue with you. And there's other things that I take a personal position on that you know nothing about, right? So again, I go back to that, like, put on a CEO coat, mm-hmm. put on Tara t-shirt or whatever the, you know, complimentary pair is there.
Yes.
But it is a different time. It's a very different time. And hard, like I said. But when I relax into it and say, okay, there's no perfecting this.
Yeah.
And it's a combination of me having integrity for who I am and what I think. And staying in dialogue, which I think fundamentally for so many of these challenging issues is the start anyway. If we can't have a conversation and be on opposite sides and hear each other, we're not making any change, right? I'm not making a change by writing an article in the newspaper. I think I'm making a change, right, when I sit with, quote, opposing parties and I'm able to stay at the table.
Yeah.
So, but it's different than before. Different than when I
grew up. And I just had this thought, too. Like, the very thing that you're handling internally, you're also coaching your clients.
Yes.
I feel like there's got to be a lot of, how I would characterize it as I'm listening to you, but in terms of it's transferable because you're coaching your clients in this way also, right?
So.
And
very
with respect to environment and culture and the people side of things and how people are built and how do they get stuff done in terms of their, you know, the OD side.
It's so true. Yeah. And there's times that it's like, geez, maybe we should be better at this. Right. Or this is emergent and everybody's figuring this out right now.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what we think is working. Maybe it's a piece of it. Maybe it's a tactic. Maybe it's a habit, and make sure we keep surfacing the things that are repeatable.
Yeah.
That's the part that feels important and useful. And to your point, very few jobs are you living the thing, right? That
so
you're consulting
true.
On. I mean, my God, you can find your way into that, but it's very obvious in the work that we do.
For sure. Yeah. And then 2 minutes on what are you seeing in terms of your clients right now? Let's do a little commercial for The Clearing with respect to some of the needs that you're seeing where your group is really effective and what you're seeing in terms of the impact that you're able to make. Talk just a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think, one space that's growing from a demand standpoint and that we're seeking to partially fulfill for our clients is individuals who are in very technical fields. That might be, say, an example is law enforcement, are humans in those fields who need time set aside to grow as leaders, right? In tandem with the field work that they're doing. And so that sometimes shows up as organizations or government agencies buying training. Sometimes it shows up as coaching, right? This is the space that you and I occupy together. But it's being applied, I think, more and more in higher stress jobs based on the complexity of the problems that the government and others are trying to solve. So I see that continuing. So it's not really a new thing we're offering.
Yeah.
It's just new people wanting it because I think the intensity of their positions is growing or the time that they've sat in the seat has reached a point where they're like, geez, I need to learn how to cope here, right? How to have resilience in this. So that's one arena. Another arena is organizations trying to, quote, measure their effectiveness. It's getting prompted in part by the debate around where you get your work done.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on site? Are you at home? All those pieces. And the conversation can feel like a ping pong match. I think until we figure out how we're measuring effectiveness at the individual, team, and organizational levels, we can't get out of ping pong. Be on site. Don't be on site. I'm doing the same thing I did at home. And that, like, we're going to stay there forever, right? Senior leaders in government are testifying before Congress, and the conversation is still about days on site. Like, that's not where the conversation is.
Yeah.
The conversation's about, are we effective? And not just, is so-and-so employee comfortable working from home, but what's the impact of them working from home on their team? What's the impact on a customer? So we're experimenting a bit with one of our clients inside DOJ relative to this to say, like, let's have a different conversation here, because recently the agency dictated mm-hmm. days on site.
Yeah.
And it's causing, right, all sorts of unrest, understandably. So organizational effectiveness, people continuing to learn and grow, you know, when they're in fields that otherwise don't allow them to be as humane as other mm-hmm. fields. And then maybe the last piece in my mind, and it's also my interest area, is the overlap between organizations' safety and security, and the ability for the, say, chief security officer to work side by side with, like, the CEO or equivalent. They don't often hear each other. It's very siloed, right? And often the CEO will say, well, that's security's job. And then maybe not always do the hard work to understand the decisions that CSO is trying to make and the impact of the chief executive officer's decision on the CSO. So that is the new, I think, sort of like functional divide. Mm-hmm. To me, it reminds me of back when IT was starting, remember, and all the CIOs were like, I want a seat at the table. And then they finally not only got a seat at the table, they started making the table that everybody was doing the work on, right? Because we're so embedded in our IT infrastructure. Now I think our ability to understand what a safety and security look like is becoming more important because of geopolitics and world events. So
I absolutely agree. And that was one of the things I loved about my life at Deloitte, is that we often intersected with the Office of Security, and then my group and our employment attorneys, and then the Office of the CEO. And because of the nature of the work, it was crisis.
Yeah.
And so it was fascinating. It was fascinating. And it was in those moments, while you're in crisis and it's challenging, you really start to unpack some of those behaviors that I think when it's business as usual, it's very easy to bifurcate and say, you know, and to be siloed. So, mm-hmm. so I think that is really interesting and of great value, because when we would either simulate something mm-hmm. and you'd start to see what the behaviors or the tendencies and the frustration. You get a real view if, like, comms is waiting for tech.
Yes.
And tech has these hurdles, and it wasn't until we were in a simulation or in an actual crisis that you, like, this is what I'm up against.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, oh,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now I have some grace, and I can, let me do what I can on my side while you're answering that. You know, you just have an awareness, which then I think does impact performance overall. So I think that's a really cool space to be moving in and to
see, and if it moves too, right? I was thinking too, you know, when I did earlier in the 2000s work in the emergency response field,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a technical term called a mutual aid event.
Yeah.
Right, where they name it as such. And then they know that there's different parts of the emergency response system that's coming in to, that has to coordinate in order to solve the issue. We don't have that equivalent inside organizations enough, right?
Yes.
This is actually a mutual aid event, right? Like, it actually has tentacles to all these people, because people grow up in their function, mm-hmm. and then they're like, I'm doing a thing, and they can't see the downstream impact, or they can't develop compassion for the other function. And it's like, that's something we could borrow, right? It exists today. Like, just like slap it on inside an organization, right? You think totally differently about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Keep me posted.
Yes, I will. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about soft skills.
Yes.
In terms of the ones for you that you think are the most critical. You have an interesting vantage point, either as a CEO and then leading a team, as someone in your own career, you know, what has benefited you. So I think, you know, you could probably see within your workforce as well, or even on your clients, what's lacking. So I feel like you could come at it from a lot of different perspectives or different hats that you wear. If you could just talk about one or two that you think are critically important and from what vantage point.
Mm-hmm. One for me is, like, really conscious and intentional curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Reflecting on, am I asking any questions right now? Am I curious about myself or the other person I'm engaging with? Because it's such, it opens up so much. Geez, I'm not asking questions. I'm not curious. What might I be missing? So to me, curiosity is, like, fundamental, and it serves you at every single level, and it, like, allows you to kind of check yourself and look for the thing that you're not otherwise tuned to look for, right? Helps you a little bit with some bias and other things. So curiosity feels really important, which and what how that would look, right, is literally asking questions, right, in terms of the behavior that's observable. Another one that I'm learning that feels more and more important over time is when people enter a team, to be aware of what, based on their world and life experience, feels appropriate to exhibit in order to belong on that team. And so I'm learning a lot about different race experiences. And as a white person, I would come on a team in this way and think all of these behaviors are okay and acceptable and celebrated. But if I'm a person of color, not so much. And then how that plays out, if the manager can't hold those distinctions, again, as just possibilities, it's not every single person of color does it this way, every single white person does it that way. But I'm learning a lot about when people land in that early stage, landing on a team and wanting to be powerful, how do those diversity dimensions impact how they show up? And then what questions can you ask in order to kind of have the team calibrate itself so that people learn along the way, but also show up and have something to offer immediately? So many of our project teams are like, you get hired on day one, and on day two, you are on the project team with the customer, right? And so that's not easy. And so we each cope in different ways, right, and have different rule sets. But I think I'm learning a lot about the ability to have those types of conversations.
Yeah, it's interesting as you're talking. One of the things that I think it's important to mention is the patience to let that mature and become integrated into the new system. And I think everything's so fast paced now. I was just thinking about a client where, you know, it's probably been a year and a half before the real authentic version of a person is really sort of being seen because of the things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think the patience of the person that's in the leadership role or the patience of people around them. And sometimes you just have the benefit of time where you're like, everybody's doing, you know, busy delivering. And then all of a sudden it's been a year and you're like, oh, look at how this person's evolved. Mm-hmm. But I do think like just the idea of intentionally recognizing it as something and then just the patience and being open and the learning, all of that integrated. I just feel like it's, and then the dialogue maybe. That people are willing to have the dialogue. It's very hard.
It's very hard. And, you know, and I try to read things on sort of like, opposite sides of issues or different dimensions. Yeah. And I just picked up this book around, which I might classify as a bit more conservative, but I don't even know if that's fair, but on the rise of victimization culture. Mm-hmm. And like, well, how does that sit with somebody who's had multiple work experiences and are coming into your organization and it feels a lot like the last one, right? In a negative way, right? In terms of their ability to integrate. And so I'm trying to like pull those pieces together because from a management seat, that's what's required. You know, like you don't have the convenience of, I think, you don't have the convenience of sitting on this side or that side. It's not how the business operates. It's not how humans in your business exist.
Yeah.
So I keep trying to look at, again, what are the cultural forces that are setting expectations across employees? How do I acknowledge them? How do I not yield to all of them, right? How do I stay respectful to what we're trying to do as a business? And there's probably not enough places yet where we can really have a good constructive conversation on like, this is what I'm seeing. How might I address it? Like, what's another thing I can try? It ends up getting really theoretical or very, like, again, political. And I'm like, where's that in-between space where we can be like, okay, but I got an employee. I'm trying to do a thing. This is my value set. What are the ways that I do it? And if that fails, do I have a backup? We don't have any backups. In some cases, we don't have a first approach. But in other cases, we don't have a second and third approach. You know?
Yeah. It's like you want that like bubble, like a bubble space. Yes. It's like, let's go, you know, they have all these reality shows where they go to confessionals. Yes. It's like, let's go into this space that we know we can say anything, we can be anything, and we can throw it all out there. And we know that the intent is positive and that it's reserved just for this space. And it's just hard to get there and be able to get. All right. And then lastly, it would be around your younger self with parents that have kids. Sometimes it's the, if you have a child that you would put your arm around. But in terms of when you think about your journey to date and the advice that you would give yourself to make the path just a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. You know, now that you've been through some stuff and you've been on this journey and the, you know, I can't even imagine the last 10 years, maybe a few more gray hairs over that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
But depending, you know, at what point you think it would be helpful. But yeah, what advice would you have to give your younger self to make that path just a little bit easier?
I think, you know, because of sometimes our a more traditional academic environment, which is what I grew up in, I was a bit programmed into I'm good at, I'm not good at. And I wasn't completely aware that you can get better at things over time. And, you know, because you have classes and they start on a day and they end on the semester. There's all these sort of made up, like, temporal environments that we're in, I think, as we grow up. And then we make a decision. We're like, okay, well, I had that math class and I didn't do well in it, so I'm bad at math. And that's not really how the rest of your life works, right? Like, it's just, it's not that conclusive. And so I feel like if I were talking to my younger self, it, you know, don't be so quick to judge or determine what you're good or bad at based on this one experience or this one class, because you're developing your sense of yourself, right? But I had no, you know, no sense of that. So I made a lot of judgments on myself that weren't entirely useful. And what that resulted in, I think, at times, is I didn't see options available to me. And I grew up, by classification, fairly privileged, right? Like, my parents were school teachers, school nurse. I wasn't, you know, like, I don't have a trust fund, you know, to be, like, extreme on it. But I think, wow, how quickly we just shut off our horizons because, like, we did bad on that test, you know, especially if you're sort of self-critical in nature. So that would be the thing that I'd be like, no, you just did bad on that one test.
Yeah.
Or that one class. Now, what do you want to do about it, right? Do you care about it enough to make an adjustment to improve or not? Again, all choices that we're making along the way. So, like, slower to judge myself, I think.
I love it. I love it. And I think it ties into the self-limiting beliefs and feeling like I can't do it. Sure you can. It's just, what do you want to put in to change it?
Yes.
And I think that's such, God, it applies to so much.
It does.
Like, it really can, in business and in personal, in terms of like the effort to change, to maybe change a path or to change your knowledge of something or your acumen of something, for sure. Mm-hmm. This has been a real pleasure.
Yeah, what a gift. Good timing.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's really, I feel like I could talk to you for hours.
Yeah,
so.
Same.
Thank you, Tara, for joining me on Relatable. I'm so fortunate to have met you and value our connection and your counsel. In this episode, I really liked what you said about not judging yourself so you don't block yourself from opportunities, and the intentional curiosity and awareness of others and their background and culture. Thank you to Missy for producing this episode and to Hannah for your support. A big thank you to our Relatable community. If you enjoyed this conversation, please take a moment and subscribe and rate us on your favorite streaming platform. Relatable is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, and you can find more information about Relatable and our sponsor by visiting tfasoftskills.com. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable. Stay connected.